Hello and welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin. On this podcast, we discuss politics, geopolitics, economics and culture with leading thinkers, authors and commentators. Today, I'm joined by Elizabeth Brough, author of the new book Goodbye Globalization and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council think tank. How did globalization develop? Is it really over? What will stand in its place? Globalization in its most recent model developed out of the enormous changes from the 1970s onwards. The international monetary system was transformed. Capital flowed across borders, aided by new technology, ushering in financialization. China liberalized its economy, manufacturing or a lot of it shifted. New markets emerged as globalization swept the world. The wall came down and communism collapsed. Since the end of the Cold War, many saw the adoption of market economics by previously communist countries as a sign that a liberal democratic system of government had prevailed. Those who argued for globalization said that if goods, services, and dollars crossed borders, then soldiers would not. Now the world is changing again. War has returned to Europe with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the US and China are at loggerheads over Taiwan, and then there's the Middle East. There are concerns about supply chains and the viability of the global trading system. All themes addressed in Goodbye Globalization. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So how did this book come into being? When did you start writing it and what prompted you to embark on this story?
My background is in national security, but a number of years ago, I started hearing from business people about things they were noticing in countries like China, well, China and Russia, and things were just not going as well as they used to. It felt more less welcoming, almost hostile. And this is at the time when nobody really was talking about any sort of changes to globalization. There were a few think tankers who were saying, well, we should decouple, but that was more wishful thinking on an academic platform. But I started hearing from business people about things that were changing that made them less certain that continuing to operate in Russia and China was the right strategy. And I thought this is a massive shift because, as you were saying in the introduction, globalization was built on the fact that other countries were opening up, were introducing free markets that would allow Western and other companies to operate anywhere in the world and build incredible efficiency because they could transport goods and indeed services around the world seamlessly and put up the manufacturing hubs wherever it was convenient and indeed also set up retail wherever it suited them. So then I thought, well, somebody should write about this, and I decided it should be me. And I wanted to do it as the story of the rise and now accelerating fall of globalization as told through the lives and the careers of people who have executed it, politicians and business leaders and ordinary people, because we've all been involved in globalization. It's not an abstract concept. It really is something that has affected or impacted for better or worse everyone on this planet. And then I started writing, and while I was writing, the stumbling accelerated, and now the world seems to have almost collectively lost faith in globalization. And that's really what matters, because globalization is something that, if you believe in it, it does happen, which is what happened in the 80s and 90s. But if people lose faith in it, it doesn't matter to say, well, you can't say, you can say, but it will have no effect. You can say, you can still do business in China, you can still do business in lots of other countries. If people lose faith in globalization, it will just retreat, and that's what's happening.
So you begin the book with an account of globalization accelerating at breakneck speed after the fall of the Soviet Union. It was a very exhilarating time, wasn't it?
Extremely. I wasn't very old at the time, but I still remember it. And of course, for the politicians, the policymakers, and the business leaders who were involved at the time, it was just an incredible opportunity, not just to make money, but to be part of an era that was reshaping the world. If you were a banker, you could go to China and not just make money, but help educate a whole generation of Chinese bankers, help China set up a financial system. It was incredible, was it not? Same thing in Russia. Lots of Westerners went there to essentially teach the Russians how to do business, how to set up a free market. I'm not sure how well they succeeded. But at least they went there and they experienced this exhilarating decade or so of just endless opportunities. And yes, there was a lot of opportunism involved, but there was also, I think, a lot of faith in this new era that had dawned, where we were going to work more closely together with countries that had been our adversaries, and we were going to share not just money and commerce, but values. And that succeeded in a number of countries that had been behind the Iron Curtain, as you know very well, Ian, because you write about these things a lot. It succeeded in Poland, in East, the former East Germany, Czechoslovakia, which then became the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and all these countries. It succeeded spectacularly well. Now they are full-fledged members of the Western family of nations that share free markets and liberal democratic values. Mm. But I think it's hard to really, these couple of decades later, 3 decades later, to even appreciate what an extremely hopeful time the early 90s were, and what the difference one could make even as a business person.
Mm. And what did the West get out of it? What did we get out of it in return, do you think? I suppose it ushered in an era of very low inflation as well, because people thought it was down to the genius of or otherwise of Western central bankers, but actually all of those cheap products coming out of China and other then regarded as developing economies but now really significant economies, those goods were cheaper being imported by the West, which then was a dampener in terms of inflation, which the West thought was down to its own genius but was actually a product of globalization. So it was something which every consumer benefited from in some way.
It really was. And if you think back to perhaps when you were growing up and when people, well, our age were growing up, it wasn't the case that you could just throw away something that broke. People a bit older than us will remember mending socks, or their mothers mending socks. And compare that to the era from the 90s onwards. Who ever mends anything? It's so cheap to get any product. And you might want to buy, and it arrives from any other part of the world. And you don't have to worry about where it's made, how it gets to you. It just happens. And what we, the West, got out of it was, in the first place, extremely, just enormous opportunities for our businesses to expand. So during the Cold War, they had been operating within the Western world with a few outposts in countries that were sort of open, but still pretty protectionist. So if they set up operations there, it was essentially sort of a clone of something they were doing in the West. And with globalization, they could specialize, they could set up hubs that serviced the whole world or particular regions, and it became so efficient, and shipping made it all possible by also becoming extremely efficient and shipping at very low cost, which is why it increased prosperity but not inflation. Mm. We can get all these products, and I think it's worth remembering that the digital revolution happened at the same time. So if we hadn't had globalization, we may have had computers, but they would be unattainable for ordinary people, and not to mention smartphones, which would also be unattainable for ordinary people. Now we have all of that, and virtually everybody can afford it. So that's the first thing globalization brought. And then, of course, we thought it brought peace, because it meant that countries would be so closely linked to us, and we thought we were also exporting our values to them. And so there were two sort of strikes in favor of globalization. It was that if you trade with another country, you're not going to fight a war with it, which turned out to be false. And it was also the idea that these countries, Russia, China, and the other countries, will adopt our values. So a war was becoming impossible, and that turned out to be a false assumption.
So you quote on that, you quote the 19th century French economist who said, when goods do not cross borders, soldiers will. And also the West German maxim, which I'm not going to attempt to pronounce correctly, meaning change happens sort of through trade. This was the dominant narrative, wasn't it, in foreign affairs terms? Policymakers, diplomats, people practicing statecraft thought, and it's interesting how this happened, because it is a bit of a. There are other examples in history of that being a delusion. You know, the First World War happens at a time when many of the European economies are actually very integrated, and cultural connections between Germany and England in particular, Britain, but England in particular, thinking in terms of things like classical music or just culture broadly, have incredibly close ties. It would have been almost unimaginable to many in England and Germany that England and Germany could fight in 1914 or would be dragged into that horrendous war, but nonetheless it happened. So why is it, do you think, that policymakers this time thought it's different? Is it because it was a bigger global process, or is it just historical amnesia that policymakers tend to have? It's just people love the delusion that it's different this time?
Well, I think we all want to be part of some sort of historical movement. So when one pops up, we embrace it and as you say, engage in a bit of amnesia. But it was also, I think, that so many of these countries had tried something different, whether it was authoritarian rule in some Latin American countries, or communism or socialism behind the Iron Curtain and China. And so it was the idea that, oh, they've tried that and it didn't work for them. And in some countries it was the population that deposed the regime. In other countries it was the regime that said, well, it's not really working, let's try something different. But in all cases it was a change from something that wasn't working towards the system that we have. And so the West thought, oh, they're becoming like us, and they'll become just as friendly and collaborative as we are within the Western world. And yes, we have disagreements, but we solve them within our structures. And that was the hope. And of course, with some countries, it has worked. The former Warsaw Pact countries are productive members for the most part of the EU and NATO. Mm. But It was really, I think, a little bit of hubris to think that everybody would inevitably go down the path of Western liberal democracy. There's nothing inevitable about with Western liberal democracy. Neither in a country like China, nor in a country like Saudi Arabia, which was, of course, among another group of entrants to this globalized economy.
It's interesting how long it took people to have that realization about China in particular. I can remember. I mean, it seems obvious now, and Fukuyama's written about this, and Neil Ferguson has written about this. But in 2012, when Xi effectively becomes leader, the assumption is from Western policymakers is just ignore that Marxism stuff and ignore his political writing. He's obviously part of that arc of history, which means ever greater liberalization in China. China is becoming, as you put it, more like us in political terms. And actually, he wasn't. He was a shift back to totalitarianism, and he meant what he said in his writing. That's 2012, but Western policymakers, people running governments, still don't really see that in 2015 or 2016. You could argue, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, but that Donald Trump was one of the first people to see it. And the consensus then shifts from being as friendly as possible towards China, towards a different posture, particularly in the US, but then it happens in the UK with Huawei. So that process takes 5 or 6 years. Do you think it is, if this is the end of globalization or this form of globalization, is it as simple as being, is the trigger, what I just described there, the change in the Chinese leadership, or is it also what Putin does? To what degree are they coordinating and cooperating? But it does seem to be a shift back to a war era, if you like. Maybe Putin is the instigator of the process, not just with February 22 and Ukraine, but what happened years earlier in Ukraine.
I think it's several different strands that have come together, totally unrelated. So the first one is the resentment that globalization created among our citizens at home, mm-hmm. the ones who felt that they had paid the price for globalization and others benefited. People had been laid off from factories. And yes, new jobs arrived in the service sector, for example. But if your life and your family's life is shaped by work in a factory, and then you're not going to say, well, that's I'll just take a job in a cafe then. It just doesn't work like that. You may find another job and work in it, but you become resentful. And that's what happened in so many places, especially in America, where the government really did nothing to soften the blow for the people who had been disadvantaged by globalization, you know, the manufacturing exodus to China. But it was the most pronounced in the US, but it existed in other countries as well, including here in the UK. So that was one strand. And then China's increasingly reluctant participation in globalization. You can say, well, they never intended to be completely transparent and active participants in globalization as we had built it up. They just did what they had to do while they were waiting for WTO membership, and then they didn't really bother fulfilling their obligations anymore. But I think after 2008, after the financial crisis, there was a shift that was becoming quite noticeable, which was that China or Chinese officials were beginning to say or think that the US-led financial system isn't benefiting us. It's we should retreat a bit. So that sort of added to their maybe not full-blown enthusiasm about globalization in the first place, or globalization on their... They were already pursuing globalization on their terms. And then, of course, we have Putin, who showed that even though globalization has brought incredible prosperity to Russia, that's not his top priority. And I think, for me, this is the realization of one of the things I've realized writing this book, that for many leaders, increased prosperity for their population is not the top priority. They may have completely different priorities. For example, staying in power, taking some territory from another country, it varies, but it's just not the case that increasing prosperity is every leader's top priority.
They're interested in historical legacy, Putin's very strange ideas about Russian greatness and Russia's place in Europe. But it's what you described there on the financial crisis. I mean, it's several things. Firstly, China, I suppose, the hubris is you can explain it because China helps the West out of the financial crisis, doesn't it? I mean, it's essentially... If the West had had the financial crisis and it hadn't had the Chinese economy functioning as it was and a source of cheap goods, then the West would have been in even more trouble. And China saw itself as helping to prop up the American system, American financial system. So it starts to think, well, maybe the West is decadent and weak and relies on China. But then the thing that happens, I suppose, at home domestically in the US, is that you get a financial crisis, which is that the financial crisis exacerbates the effects of the manufacturing problems that you describe in the book, but it also coincides with the opioid disaster, an opioid epidemic. So the 10 years that follow the financial crisis are very bleak in major parts of America, which then, of course, leads to Donald Trump. Donald Trump can be explained through that prism of the opioid crisis, financial disaster, and a lot of people feeling that the disposable society you characterized earlier of cheaper goods, but that they're the ones paying the price.
Yes, and I think what policymakers or decision makers who considered, as they all did, considered globalization inevitable, what they forgot that people are not just interested in more possessions. They want to feel that they have value. And what happened when so many well-paid and skilled jobs moved to China and other countries was that people felt discarded. They felt they weren't taken. They were taken for granted. And they became resentful. And I remember, Ian, back when I was at university, which was in the early to mid-90s in what used to be East Germany, was then newly reunited Germany. And so many people had lost their jobs at that time because the state-owned companies had shut down, were being sold off, and it was just massive unemployment. But people were receiving unemployment benefits, so it wasn't like they were destitute. It was an acceptable life, but they lost all sense of identity and self worth, and it was horrible. It was a very depressing time those years, because you had scores of people who felt they were disposable, and then that's what happened all over the Western world with globalization, that the people who had stable jobs, had taken maybe pride in what they were doing, felt that they didn't matter. And then they also felt that elites were taking decisions far away from them, whether it be in corporate headquarters somewhere else or in capitals or in Brussels. And then somebody came and said, i.e. Donald Trump came and said, I'm listening to you. And so he very cleverly took advantage of that sort of simmering feeling, which really, I think, would have been possible for other politicians to address, but they didn't. I don't think they realized it was there, or that there was a growing problem.
Mm. And the class you described there even held their own festival. Davos. I mean, for any voter watching, I'm not suggesting that voters were glued to Davos, but they were hearing people like Donald Trump and on networks like Fox in the US and elsewhere, you know, in the UK. They were aware that there was that global business and political class that was gathering together, you know, rather nice place in the mountains, and saying, well, listen, borders don't matter so much. We've moved beyond that. Globalization has solved a lot of the problems of sort of national sovereignty and competing nations. This is the way that the world is going to be. And it all looks a hell of a lot less confident than it did back then. But now, in terms of globalization ending, how do you respond to those who say, well, look, there's still, you know, agree with your analysis on China and Russia, but there are still huge amounts of trade with China and other neighbouring states, that's still being done? Or do you say this protectionism, this wave of protectionism and a trade war, it's only just getting started?
There is lots of trade taking place with Russia and China still, and many Western companies are still in Russia, though many have left. And the reason many of them are still there is that the Russians are making it extremely difficult for companies to leave, and essentially they're keeping them there as
hostage.
Exactly. And then with China, I think anybody who has ever moved house knows how difficult it is, and it is like that for companies operating in China. It's mostly manufacturing, if it's not retail. I think retail will stay there because if you're going to sell to Chinese customers, you've got to be there. But for manufacturing, imagine having to move a factory with the massive supply chain that supplies that factory. And we are not talking about the small factory, because the reason that companies went to China was that they could do things at scale and service the rest of the world. So these are massive facilities we're talking about. And imagine trying to first find another location where you can set up that factory or those factories, and then bringing that long supply chain tail with you. It's not going to be one country. It's not going to be just India or just the Philippines or just Vietnam. It's going to have to be a collection of countries, and so you have to figure out the transportation of your goods between that new hub that you're building. It's extremely difficult, and the companies that first started leaving China were the ones that first entered China. Some of the first entered China, meaning the apparel and footwear sectors of lower tech, where you could really make goods very cheaply in China. And at some point they realized the Chinese don't want us here anymore. So they sort of began executing that exodus a few years ago. And even for them, it was difficult, as low tech as they are compared to smartphone manufacturers and so forth. So it will take a long time before we start seeing any change in what looks like very vigorous trade with China. But what matters is that the faith in globalization is gone. And then the other thing to remember is that for Western executives, expat executives, it's just not attractive to work in China anymore. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, Chinese executives can run the business because they've been, we have a whole generation of Chinese executives. But it's another part of that fraying link with China, that the fact that Western executives don't consider it a career advantage to work in China, and their families don't want to come with them because there is the great firewall, so they can't use the sort of websites that you can use here in the West. So it's just becoming far less attractive, and I think that's why over the next few years we'll see more and more news of companies setting up some sort of facility in another country. It's already happening, but it's not going to be quick. And then the last thing to remember is that Western businesses still want to serve the Chinese market. So what they're doing and will increasingly do is that they will clone their business. They will have one business that serves China and another perhaps French-ward hub that serves the rest of Asia, or perhaps Asia and other countries. So it's extremely logistically complicated to execute.
Do you think we're heading then, thinking in terms of the next 6 months to a year, thinking of the American election, are we headed, as some commentators think, back to a full-scale trade war? I mean, Trump obviously has, you know, tariff potential, but thinking particularly of what China is doing on solar panels and EVs, flooding the flooding Western markets, which is creating all sorts of dislocations and concern in countries like Germany. There's a response coming, isn't there? Well, it's already the EU is thinking about how it should respond. So, is there a trade war immediately in front of us? And it's because China's economy is in so much trouble, it's facing deflation, and the regime's answer to try and get out of this terrible mess it's in because of the property bubble having burst is to try and export its way to growth.
Yeah.
So produce as much stuff as possible and undercut Western manufacturers and flood Western markets, and that way try and get the Chinese growth machine going again. And then presumably the West is not going to like that.
No, and solar panels are such a perfect example of the promise of globalization that went wrong. That then went wrong, and I think everybody remembers how Germany used to dominate solar panel manufacturing. They were very good at it, and then it became cheaper to make those solar panels in China, or Chinese manufacturers were just cheaper, and China now dominates solar panel manufacturing at the very moment where we are trying to make the green transition in our countries, and we're discovering that we are now beholden to a country that is not exactly our friend, and we need this country for our green objectives. And it's not that easy to stand up a whole new solar panel industry at home. But I think, Ian, the most immediate point ahead of any trade war is that business is no longer neutral. Globalization was so successful for 3.5 decades because everybody, every country accepted that businesses are neutral. They are not soldiers in any sort of war. They are just about money and commerce, and so you treat them as just as companies. And that has changed dramatically in the past couple of years. The U.S. sanctions against Russia, following just ahead of the Ukraine war, and then following the Ukraine war, essentially prompted Russia to weaponize business, because Russia could say, well, if you are using sanctions against us to force us to do something, we will weaponize business. And we have seen Russia crack down on Western businesses to make a point. And those Western businesses have nothing to do with geopolitics. A yogurt maker, a beer maker, I mean, these are totally sort of vanilla companies, and they are being targeted. Same thing with China. If the Chinese government wants to make a point, often it chooses to punish a Western company, and it can be Australia, even a sector. So it can be Australian winemakers that were punished after Australia dared to propose that there should be an international investigation into the origins of COVID. China then responded by imposing draconian tariffs on Australian wine, which led to an almost complete disappearance of the Chinese market for Australian winemakers. I mean, Australian winemakers are completely neutral. And the same thing has happened to Taiwanese farmers, to Ericsson, to H&M, to the entirety of Lithuania's industry. It can happen to anybody if your government says something that the Chinese authorities don't like. And I think this is the brutal awakening for Western companies, that they are vulnerable to geopolitical backlash that they have no way of predicting or let alone influencing.
Yeah. Do you think we're heading for, I've heard it described as globalization 2.0, that globalization needn't disappear entirely. This is the sort of the optimist view. I'm, as you can tell, a bit more pessimistic about it, and share your analysis. But that under globalization 2.0, you can strip out a lot of the national security stuff. So Huawei not being in the UK system, or there are other examples, but you still maintain the basics of international trade, and there's stuff which isn't then it's not critical to national resilience or security, so that's fine. So that trade carries on. So it's globalization 2.0. Is that feasible, or in the world that you're describing, everything is related to national security because everything is related to these enormous geopolitical shifts, and essentially the contest between the democracies, mainly democracies, and the autocracies?
Yes, it is possible, globalization 2.0, but not anytime soon. It will be, I think, a couple of decades before we can attempt another go at globalization. And in the meantime, we'll see blocks emerge. So the Western world will need to find more friends that our companies can trade with, where they can set up manufacturing and with which they can expand business, because we're going to need to do business with others now that we're losing more and more business with China and Russia. And that means, Ian, that we'll need to become closer with countries that are market economies and perfectly stable countries, but may not be exactly like us. So that means doing more business with China. And we can complain about various aspects of Indian democracy, but India is not a hostile country. It's a country with which we can trade. Same thing for countries in the Gulf. We will need them, and we can say, well, you don't have a perfect human rights record. Well, they, in these 3.5 decades of globalization 1.0, they have grown from being small economies to being very significant economies, and we can benefit from trading more with them, and they've also as a result of growing in importance, in economic size and importance, they've also grown in political self-belief. So they will not let us tell them how to run their domestic arrangements. And that is a bit uncomfortable for Western governments and the Western public, that the fact that we may not be able to tell countries in the Gulf what's of human rights policies to have, but we need them for trade. And I think this is the perhaps uncomfortable reality, but nevertheless undeniable reality. So we'll have that sort of block for a while, and if we don't trade with these countries, they will join the ad hoc bloc led by China. And then in 20 years or so, when the Xi experiment may have faded in China, Xi may have retired, Putin may have retired
been forcibly retired, possibly. Yeah.
Possibly. Then we can have another go at globalization, and it will be, I think, a more clear-sighted view of what's possible in countries' relations with other countries. We'll have to recognize that they're never going to be completely like us, and we can be more pragmatic, and that will, I think, lead to a more healthier relationship.
How should Europe respond to this? Because a cynic, a skeptic, would say Europe, meaning principally the EU, but Britain has similar problems, has almost sort of regulated itself into last place. So it hasn't really worked out yet how to compete in this new world that you describe. It's going to have to think where it's sourcing goods from, what its view is on commodities, because commodities are going to be a massive part of what you describe. And then, of course, I'm meaning things like lithium. The competition over that sort of stuff is going to be intense. And Europe just seems to be stuck in a regulatory model that is, I don't know what it's based on. Because it's not really even based on globalization. Whatever they're trying to do, it's clearly not working in terms of growth, either on this side of the channel or in the European Union. What can and what should Europe do? How can it make its living and get some growth?
It's fascinating, and what you describe applies most of all to Germany, which really made globalization its identity. And in the book, I have a number of representatives of Gen Z, and one of them, a young German man of Arab origin, he was so articulate. And at one point he said, What is Germany's role in this new world? We stood for globalization. What are we about now? And that really is Germany's conundrum at the moment. I mean, they embraced change through trade, so Wandel durch Handel, more than any other country, because it was something that they could articulate It was the perfect position for West Germany and then reunited Germany to take, because who could object to trade? And if you have trade, you don't have wars. It was just Germany's a perfect profile for Germany, and executed it very well, and has benefited greatly from globalization. But now that model is over, change through trade and in globalization itself, what does Germany stand for? And indeed, what does the EU stand for? And I think, Ian, what the EU really needs is a strategic thinker of the caliber of Helmut Schmidt, who was Chancellor of West Germany in the 70s and 80s, somebody who can articulate a vision, because if you don't have that, then you have a sort of bureaucracy just chugging along. At this massive juncture, you need somebody to articulate what it is that the EU is going to stand for and how it's going to execute it. And that really, at the moment, Emmanuel Macron is the only person who can do that. And let's hope he does it.
Do you think the European elections create an opportunity for that to happen. I'm pessimistic that something that a new dispensation will actually grapple with these questions. But it looks as though there's going to be a shift. Populist parties are on the rise, but the elections may actually be about the recovery of the EPP as well. So there's a possibility you could end up with a more market-focused, competition-focused conversation in Europe. I don't know how you then set about deregulating to try and make the EU more competitive. But there's a glimmer of hope, isn't there?
There is, and there is also a massive opportunity to rearticulate what we are about as Western countries. And I think actually that the retreat of globalization is not all bad. It wasn't working that well. And then Putin and Xi came along and various Western politicians, to a smaller extent, came along and dealt it a death blow. So now we have another chance of building globalization that works better and to the satisfaction of more people and more countries. So it's an incredible opportunity at the moment that we wouldn't have had. And I'm not trying to be Pollyannish about the Ukraine war in no way or about Xi's authoritarian machinations. But nevertheless, this is a situation we have that globalization is struggling mightily and that we'll have another opportunity to first think about what it should look like and then execute it accordingly.
So the liberal democracies have to get their act together. The other dimension, of course, is potential conflict or warfare. It's happening in Ukraine. And you quote some startling statistics. This jumped out at me. In 2018, only 11% of Americans thought China was their greatest enemy, while 51% thought it was North Korea. In 2023, 50% of Americans thought China was their greatest enemy and 35% thought it was Russia. That's a huge shift in consciousness. In that context, is conflict then inevitable, do you think?
It's not, and I think the saving grace, if there is any saving grace, is that Russia and China can achieve so much by not using military means, and they can do that by weaponizing globalization, because there are still so many links, there are so many Western businesses still in their countries, there is so much infrastructure that connects our countries, infrastructure that only serves us but can be harmed by them. There's so much you can do without using military force, and you can do it with impunity because we don't know how to respond to it. So if China decides to punish the UK in some way for something that the Prime Minister might have said, then there are plenty of companies that can punish. It doesn't need to show up with any sort of naval vessel in the English Channel and intimidate us. And this is the frightening thing, that our businesses that still operate globally, because they have to operate globally while they're retreating, they are so vulnerable at the moment because both China and Russia are increasingly aggressive. Our companies are such an easy target for them. But then there is, of course, the question of will we have a wider war? And that is a very relevant and increasingly urgent question, because Putin, since he's already made himself an international pariah, he's not going to listen to Western leaders who say, well, you know, come to your senses, retreat from Ukraine. He has already completely lost his international standing, so he might as well keep going by targeting another country. And Xi Jinping has also made himself undesirable among international leaders, and I think that makes them both so dangerous. During the Cold War, Warsaw Pact leaders wanted to be seen as you know, belonging to, being at home in the fine corridors of power, being accepted there and so forth. And that's why they signed the Helsinki Accords in the 70s, even though they didn't want to, but it would have been too embarrassing not to. But Putin and Xi have completely discarded any ambition to be seen as collaborative or respectable leaders from a Western perspective, and that means they can do anything they like, and no pleading from us will make them change their minds.
Also, on the China point, that economic decline that we described earlier, that deflation, sometimes in an economic crisis or fading, an era of fading economic growth, it then suits a dictator or it suits a war leader to have a war. I mean, it's a nationalistic distraction. It rallies the country and it creates another focal point for national policy if the economy is not growing. So there is there's a risk there, isn't there? Where could wars break out? They could break out with obviously Taiwan, Korea is very interesting, and people are very worried about Korea. If the conflict is frozen or there's some sort of peace deal, or God forbid Putin won, which is possible in Ukraine, then where does Putin go next in terms of menacing Poland or the Baltic states or Finland and Sweden? So there's quite a lot of scope for conflict.
There is, and then we haven't even mentioned the Red Sea or the Strait of Hormuz, yeah, where there are so many actors. There's global shipping that has all kinds of links to the West and to other countries, and there are also now those wishing to harm global shipping, and it's not clear what anybody can do about it. The US and UK are trying in the Red Sea, and the US is trying in the Strait of Hormuz, but there is a limit to what they can do without bringing serious risk of escalation with Iran. So they have to be very careful. But what's interesting there in the Red Sea is that Russian and Chinese vessels are allowed to sail through unharmed. And you would think that in a globalized world, with China having the world's largest navy, that it would take its responsibility as a major power in the world to try to maintain order in the world. But that's not the sort of country it is. So it's left to the US and the UK, and the UK, which no longer has a particularly large navy, to try to maintain order. And I think that speaks volume about the world as it exists today. And it's so just the incredible abdication of responsibility by China for the global world order. And then the fact that we depend so much on the globalized economy that attacks on ships in the Red Sea and the Strait of Hormuz actually have a tangible effect on business activities here at home.
What do you think the impact on public opinion is going to be? Because you described earlier the backlash against globalization, people feeling left behind, that story across the US. It's a factor in Brexit. It's a factor in what's happening in European politics at the moment. Is it possible, do you think, to rally public opinion to support what needs doing in terms of extra defence spending is obviously going to be required? Things are going to be tougher, not just for the next 6 months, but potentially for the next decade or so, as all of this plays out. Do you think electorates or voters are furious about everything? They're furious with their political class. They don't like what's happened on cost of living and the economy. But can it be explained to them what's going on here? Or are you fatalistic about the capacity of electorates to absorb and adapt to this? It's a huge challenge because it's the end of what you described, which in one sense, in consumerist terms, was just an easier world.
It was an easy world, and perhaps too easy, and so easy that we didn't appreciate how much really magic went into getting all these goods produced at a low cost and getting them to us. It was an incredible achievement by globally operating companies. But I think the current situation can be explained to people. But what shouldn't happen is that whenever people voice dissatisfaction or unhappiness with various elites, that we then just tell them that they are wrong. I think everybody wants to be listened to and wants to be taken seriously, which is why we're having this really extraordinary rise of populist parties, because they give people the idea that, or the perception that they listen to them while other parties don't. So other parties and indeed other elites would do well to not just talk to people, but listen to them. And one idea I had a decade ago when I was a fellow at the Reuters Institute at Oxford, and I had started noticing this popular or citizen unhappiness with the political and media elites. My research there was about this phenomenon and what to do about it. And one thing I proposed was for established media organizations, the so-called mainstream media, to invite citizens, ordinary citizens, to their news conferences and to their newsrooms to see how they operate. And ordinary citizens would discover that it's not nefarious at all. There are certain decisions you have to make about the news of the day. And if something is not included, it doesn't mean that it was deliberately excluded. It was just other news happening was more important. I think that sort of outreach would reduce or even help us get rid of a lot of the anger that exists towards the elites, or dissatisfaction or unhappiness. And companies could do the same thing. Globally operating companies, they could invite ordinary citizens to their boardroom or to wherever their executives meet so that they could be informed about the sort of decision-making that goes on. But excluding people and then telling them they are wrong when they voice unhappiness is just going to breed more unhappiness.
But I suppose what's going to be required is increased resilience, isn't it? But is that resilience there potentially amongst Western populations? We've heard warnings from various military figures in across Europe, actually, about what might be needed in terms of increasing the size of armies. I suppose what I'm asking is, do you think Western electorates are deep down, are they capable of that resilience, of realizing that we're in a struggle again? Sorry to sound grandiose, but it is some kind of struggle for freedom and for liberal democracy.
I think so. I mean, if people are given or helped to understand, or if they realize on their own that our country faces various crises and hostile activities, whether that be climate change or hostile countries, and that they can be play a part in keeping the country safe, I think many people would step up to the plate. One of the sort of ironic aspects of globalization is that we almost had it too good. It became a very consumerist world, and people could spend a lot of time nurturing their resentments Now we actually have lots of tasks that need to be tackled, not just by government, by governments, and not just by companies, but by everybody. So I think for many people, it's an opportunity to play a role in their local communities, to make a difference. And they are actually best positioned to take on many of these tasks. The government can't put up an all-encompassing umbrella over the entire society. We, the ordinary citizens of that society, can help boost or help build resilience much better than some government agency. It has to be in coordination, of course. But if you look at when there is a crisis during COVID, so many people signed up for the hastily erected NHS army, and in various other countries you have NGOs of people who help looking for missing people. Mm. And those are incredibly popular. And if you look at the DOE scheme in the UK, the Duke of Edinburgh Award scheme, incredibly popular, and it teaches people resilience. And so there is, I think, the will among large chunks of the population to play a role whenever a crisis occurs, and indeed before it occurs. And we just need the organizational structures for them to be able to participate.
Elizabeth Brough, on that optimistic note about resilience there. Thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to The Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin. We've been discussing Elizabeth Broad's new book, Goodbye Globalization. If you like what you heard and you want to get my weekly newsletter and all of the great work from the Reaction team, become a subscriber. Go online, www.reaction.life, and sign up. Until next time, thank you for listening.